to the healthcare panel. And this year, the theme of the panel is inventing continuity of healthcare. We have an interesting set of panels and talk about what's new in their area they're doing now to continue the care of the patient. Oftentimes, when patient leaves the clinic or hospital, continuity breaks there. So how to continue that continuum of the healthcare? So for that reason, I have Bill Fox from MarkLogic. He'll be the moderator. And he will take up the ball, and we will run with it. And once this session is finished, this room will be still available. So if you have some extra questions, you can feel free to ask them after this. Thank you. Bill?
Good afternoon. Enjoy your lunch. I'm Bill Fox. I run the healthcare and life sciences vertical for MarkLogic, and before that, I've been at companies like Emdeon and Lexis, so dealt with a lot of big data in healthcare. And we have a really interesting panel, and I'm going to allow the Andrew and Summit and Jim and Robert to introduce themselves. But we have a really nice cross section when you think about continuity of care in healthcare today. And what that means and how it's going to get affected. You know, we have represented up here hospital, the side who's trying to help the payers with the patients as they leave. Obviously, CVS's move into the MinuteClinics and whatnot has been a tremendous piece of that continuity of care. And then Robert is dealing with, you know, the intersection between academia and business and medicine. So we have a really interesting group here. So I'm going to ask them to run down quickly and introduce themselves, and then they'll give you a little 5 minutes on what they're working with. And we want to be clear that, you know, once we get there, we're open for questions at any time. I have a few, but I'm hoping that they're not all my questions. And I think given the people in the room, we should have a really open discussion. So Jim?
All right, thank you, Bill. My name is Jim Murray, Vice President of Information Technology for MinuteClinic, which is a division of CVS Health. We run clinics around the country offering basic healthcare services. I've been at MinuteClinic about 5 years in retail healthcare, just that amount of time. Prior to that, I was working at Partners Healthcare, both Mass General and Brigham, right across the river here, for about 18 years.
I'm Sumit Nagpal. I'm the CEO of Lumira USA Inc. And CIO of our parent, which is UK based. We focus on helping solve chronic conditions by engaging patients in behavior change. And I'd love to describe that and discuss that in more detail.
Hello, my name is Andrew Watt, and I'm honored to be here today. I am the Chief Information Officer and Chief Medical Information Officer for Southern New Hampshire Healthcare. We are a healthcare system that exists in Southern New Hampshire, Nashua. We have a single hospital, about 200 beds, and about 65 associated managed practices. I'm also a physician. I continue to practice in emergencies and trauma, and did my training at Johns Hopkins, which is of interest because of this show.
Hi, Dr. Richard Singerman. I wear two hats. I'm adjunct faculty in the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in the Division of Informatics. And I'm also co-founder and chief innovation officer for TrustNetMD. And what we're focused on is leveraging the principles of organizational learning and combining those with Web 2.0 and mobile technologies to create collaborative learning environments to drive the adoption of evidence-based medicine, evidence-based practices for not only clinicians, but all those folks outside of the walls of the traditional hospital and doctor's office, like social workers, community healthcare workers, and even family caregivers, who are the people and families who often take care of a loved one and may be sandwiched between taking care of a 5-year-old kid who's in school and their 90-year-old parent. And often family caregivers end up being essentially an unpaid version of a community healthcare worker.
So, you know, as you can see, what we have here is a cross-section, and a theme develops around, you know, outside of the care setting. So there's two aspects. Traditionally, when IOM looked at transitions of care, and they said there's $700 billion wasted in transitions of care, you know, they're looking at a pretty straight, you know, hospital, post-care, whether that's nursing home, home health, whatever that is. And we have some interesting approaches here. So I think it would be helpful for our next sort of round here if each person could address kind of briefly, you know, where they feel, you know, CVS made this very conscious move to be CVS Healthcare with the MinuteClinics. If each person could talk just for a few minutes about where they fit into this sort of new world where it's being recognized that, you know, care has to extend beyond the hospital or there's a quick drop off in the improvement.
Thanks, Bill. So at CVS, and I would say just a few short years ago, as MinuteClinic grew, we were looked at as a group that was breaking the continuity of care. We were providing healthcare outside of the normal realm, outside of where patients would traditionally go. And a lot of organizations came at us at that time saying, you are disrupting healthcare. You are hurting the patients. You are not doing good things for the healthcare system. We looked at it to say, we're not breaking continuity of care because continuity of care really isn't there. But what we were attempting to do and what we've really focused on over the last 5 years, you've seen a transition from CVS, which you probably all recognize as your local pharmacy, Caremark, pharmacy benefits management, a large organization providing that service to many employers, 60 million members under contract for pharmacy benefits, and now MinuteClinic, functioning to break down barriers of access to care. People will not go to the physician because it's hard to do. One of our leading doctors makes a comment as he practiced at the Brigham, said, you know, MinuteClinic's entire charge is less than parking at the Brigham. So that is a challenge. And what we are looking to do is address the on-demand need of healthcare and create essentially a patient's right to have on-demand access to basic care, something that's convenient, something that is, like MinuteClinic, open 7 days a week, open, you know, nights, weekends, and offer that service in something that is kind of a low barrier to access. It's not an intimidating facility that you have to navigate and find parking just to get your outpatient appointment. We feel that that allows people to better get engage in their healthcare, become more of an active participant. I think across all industries, you're seeing the consumer taking a very loud voice in how they want things delivered and how they want to access services. You're seeing the same thing in healthcare now. We're growing at an incredible rate. We're doing it with a focus on maintaining or building a continuity of care. When you get care at MinuteClinic, your record is sent to your primary care physician. Now, early on, that was faxing, which is, you know, beautiful. The 1990s called, they want their technology back, so we had to move on to that. We formed over 50 clinical affiliations around the country, a local one with University of Massachusetts, where we're working to integrate that data. So when you go to MinuteClinic and you're seen for your sore throat, we'll check your blood pressure. Within a very short amount of time, that blood pressure value that MinuteClinic took is in that record at UMass, at Cleveland Clinic, at UCLA, and accessible by your primary care physician. Patients are better able to work with their doctors if we can make the access to care easier. We're using nurse practitioners and physician assistants, which is another efficiency move by MinuteClinic and by CVS Health, allowing those nurse practitioners under supervision of physicians to work at the peak of their license, to take care of the earaches, the sore throats, the pink eye. That's taking those out of the physician's office, out of the emergency room. Cleveland Clinic, our fantastic partner in the Northern Ohio area, has even started sending patients to MinuteClinic to get them out of the emergency rooms. Because you could, the cost, we did a study that was published in Annals of Internal Medicine in 2009 on the comparative quality and cost between retail settings and emergency departments for what we do. And we're not treating gunshot wounds. We're not treating cardiac arrests. We're stabilizing those patients because both of those have come into our clinics. My personal favorite was the construction worker who put a nail gun through his hand. Asked the nurse practitioner if she wouldn't mind just giving that a tug and giving him something to wrap on it so he could go back to work. But that's his mentality, and that's a lot of the workers' mentalities out there, that they need to work. They need to stay with their job, and we need to offer them a place where they can go to get that basic care and bring that data forward to through our partners like UCLA, Cleveland Clinic, and others to improve the overall health. You saw CVS make a very bold move last year when we decided that as a healthcare company, we cannot sell tobacco in our stores. We cannot sell something that no amount of tobacco is safe for the human body. So we did that. It's, you know that story. It's all over the news. That was a move of this company, an evolution of this company towards a broader scope of services to serve those in need.
Okay. Summit?
Fantastic. That very inspiring story. And we happen to be incredible believers in care moving back out into the community where it belongs. And primary care and community-based care being the focus of where most care happens, with the help of social care, with the help of friends, family, key influencers, and hospitals and acute care centers really become places where you go for specialized things and procedures that can't be done in community-based settings. And so Lumira's vision, Lumira's focus is really enabling that, moving care into the community, but focusing on, especially on, those patients who need that help the most, patients with long-term chronic conditions, who need the help the most and who cost our economy an inordinate amount compared with their population. We spend, various parties have now written lots and lots of studies, conducted lots and lots of studies and published papers on how much waste happens in our healthcare economy. Out of the $3 trillion that we spend, there's essentially a generally accepted standard now that we're wasting about half of that money on things that could be done better, could be done elsewhere, could be done sooner than they're done, and therefore we're causing worse things to happen just because of how our healthcare economy operates. Out of that waste, over 60% of the spend happens on chronic conditions, on just managing chronic conditions and their side effects, their complications, their additional, the undertow that they carry, the social cost that they carry. And so Lumira's focus really is to help patients living with diabetes, to help patients living with heart failure, with COPD, with asthma, become self-determining, become activated, so they can help start managing their own conditions better. We've taken, especially focusing on diabetes, which work in both sides of the pond now, both in the US and the UK. It's now, taking the UK example, it's now established that just the diabetes problem itself will bankrupt the National Health Service there by 2025 or thereabouts, just based on that one condition itself and its complications, its side effects. And we're taking that problem on by picking up on research that's been now published over the past 3-4 years, validated clinical studies that have now shown that this problem that we think of as a lifelong disease, once you're diabetic, that for at least a certain percentage of the population that this chronic condition can be reversed. You can actually reverse type 2 diabetes, especially recently diagnosed type 2 diabetes, especially if you've just been put on insulin or you're about to be put on insulin or within a few years of having been put on insulin. You can actually reverse it, turn off insulin, and over a period of time, with the right behavior, with the right activity, with the right diet, can actually reverse its effect and wind up becoming symptom-free. And the challenges, of course, are how do you sustain that for the rest of your life? The challenges, of course, are how do you actually achieve that effect initially? And those are the exact problems that we're focused on solving. And our approach, rather than throwing pharmaceuticals at the problem, the traditional approach has been, well, you're diabetic now, and so you're on pharmaceutical treatment, and you're going to evolve from this stage to the next higher dose of pharmaceuticals and the next more serious forms of pharmaceutical control until you're dead, essentially. That's the progression of that disease. And the disease progresses in a manner that's like boiling a frog. You don't have an urgency to deal with the problem because you're okay today, but gradually, slowly, the temperature around you rises, your condition worsens, and that's now the new normal. And now you go on to the next stage. Ultimately, you ignore the disease long enough and you're heading for a lower limb amputation. You're heading for blindness. The stuff creeps up on you. And that's the problem with this disease. And so our approach really is getting patients, individuals, we don't think of them as patients, they're us, they're people like us, getting people activated to become engaged, surrounding them with friends, family, key influencers, church leaders, soccer coaches, people who they listen to help them on the journey, pull together everything we know about them from all the places where their information exists, hospitals, primary care, social care, community-based resources, home monitoring, testing, all of that information, make it available to the entire care team, including those friends and family, engage them in helping those patients then achieve, those individuals then achieve the goals that they've set, and continue that until they're symptom-free and then help them sustain that long-term. And we're in the early stages, we've proven that we can reverse it. We haven't yet proven that we can sustain it for 5 years, and that's our next challenge.
Yeah, that'll be a challenge. So, Andrew, you come at this, so, you know, CVS and the Minute Clinics are providing access, you know, this great access. Mm-hmm. Summit has, you know, his company is providing this very proactive, targeted. Now, you're coming at it from a more traditional setting, although I think you shared with me last night you have 65 or something associated. So how do you think about improving, you know, you're dealing with the acute condition, the person comes in very sick, they leave not sick. Right. And how are you thinking about this and how you integrate with this system?
Yes. So I don't take it personally that the future is to try and keep people away from me. Right? It's very interesting that, you know, I go to work in the emergency department and I take care of people. And there's a percentage of people who really need to be in the emergency department, accidents, trauma, etc. And then there's a group of people who are using the emergency department as a care setting that don't really need to use the emergency department as that care setting. And then I flip onto my administrative hat and I try to actually get those patients out of the emergency department. So my role in this panel is sort of represent the present. And you've heard a little bit about the future. And the concern, of course, is how will hospitals evolve and innovate to get to this new future? And I'll tell you, it's an incredible challenge because it's not about the data, it's about the relevant data. And that is really a struggle that we have. We run multiple EMRs. We were a best of breed solution. And that was the way to get good care and quality in the 90s. And now that is out of favor. So now it's about modernized EMRs. And it's about how we can compete with healthcare 2.0, which is the providers in the community that can offer cheaper, more convenient access. And I think the first realization that we're having in healthcare is the fact that it was always thought that the patient and physician relationship was the core. Well, it is the core, but people no longer are willing to be inconvenienced to see their doctor. They just want to see a doctor. And I think that is a dramatic change. The challenge that I have faced is, I think if you were to look at many healthcare organizations, they've gone for scale. Their approach to data continuity is to own the data, to go out and try to consume as much of this sort of cycle of inpatient care to discharge, discharge to home care, you know, to outpatient care, they try to own that whole circle or long-term care. And I think the realization is it has to be more about data continuity and interfacing. At the same token, the challenge is relevance. So in the emergency department, it's about convenience and it's about speed. But how can you provide good, high-quality care when you're drowning in data? And I think that this country had sort of a defining moment. I'm not an expert on the case, but you know, there is a man who comes to this country with Ebola and is seen in a large healthcare system with, quote, a modern EMR, and is sent home. And I think that is one of those cases that we really need to look at as CIOs in healthcare, because that's scary. That should not have happened in the acute care setting. That tells you that there's too much communication lost through technology, but the technology is not picking up that missing communication, and that's very concerning to me. I am very nervous about the future, working from the hospital side, because reimbursements are changing. Accountable care organizations and shared risk will be, you know, this modern landscape, and how will we do business with, you know, the Minute Clinics or the retail markets of the world? And then the other interesting thing is personal technology. So where does all the data that these new devices, these wearables, the Fitbits, the iPhone apps, where does all that data go? And is it really relevant to put it into the EMR, right? I mean, that is one argument. Collect all that data, pump it to sort of the owner, which is the traditional inpatient setting. But it's overwhelming. I can assure you that as a physician, when someone comes in with a printout of their, you know, Fitbit data, and you have 8 minutes to take care of that person, it's overwhelming. So my hope with being here today is to share with everyone sort of my concerns. And I guess my concerns are more in the traditional sense of, you know, the healthcare of the future still has to have the hospital. And how will the hospital, how will that inpatient care setting actually be appropriately utilized? And how will data look to people who practice medicine at the hospital?
Yes, so there are a couple of really interesting points I want to circle back on there. One was, you know, your initial saying, you know, how do we compete with these sort of healthcare 2.0 companies? And then you came back around to sort of how do we work with them?
Right.
And then the other thing, you know, that sort of gets glossed over but is a huge deal to say, you know, I have 8 minutes to see this patient. Well, how come? You know. So I think that, you know, Richard sits in a really interesting place between Hopkins, which is obviously one of the best health systems in the country, and then also in the new technology world and trying to bridge those worlds. So Richard, if you could give us a little of that, and then we're going to circle back.
Sure. Well, what's really going to be fun is I'm going to get to tell you about a new solution that's going live, where it's going into a clinical trial and it's going to be live. So you can keep that in the back of your mind. So the big problem, in one sentence, is that the U.S. wants to create better care at lower cost. That's the mantra of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And the way they want to get there, the big vision for 10 years is to create a learning health system, whatever that means. Now, since we're at MIT, and I'm, like I said, class of 87, I've got to give a nod to Peter Senge back in the Sloan School. Because he created this whole, you know, notion of the organizational learning, and we've really been applying that in our company. So our company partnered with Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the Bloomberg School of Public Health, and we were very fortunate. I previously served in the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT, actually the very first one under Dr. David Brailer, which was a very tiny $40 million operation, and then under Obama, for better or worse, it got scaled up to a $2 billion operation plus $20 billion of incentive money. And we could talk about whether that was good or not, but it was very interesting to see that progression. So one of the big problems is hospital readmissions. You know, up to, I think, between 10 and 20%, if not even more, of costs in our healthcare system will come from 30-day readmissions. So who's going to help now that our fiscal model has been changed partially through accountable care and penalties for readmission rates within the first 30 days that are avoidable? Who's going to be there helping to make sure that the patient takes their meds when they get home after the first few days, is not confused so that they don't call their doctor on day one and say, I'm confused. He says, well, you know, it doesn't sound like things are going too well and I can't see you, you know, today. You better go back to the ER. So who are going to be those new people blocking and tackling now that there's all these people with access to health insurance, but people don't have the access to their primary care physician that they used to at the speed that they did? Folks like Dr. Blumenthal, another national coordinator who was at Partners before being a national coordinator for Health IT, you know, said that the physician-patient relationship really has been fraying over the last decade. So some of the folks that are filling these new places are social workers, sometimes are the family caregivers I described earlier, those persons in the home that are helping to take care of a loved one, and the community health care worker, which is basically a community-based worker, not a lot of education per se, but very familiar with their local community and often employee of the clinic or of the hospital. They are not providing medical care. Rather, they are hopefully providing guidance on, did you take your meds for a young pregnant woman? Are you making sure not to smoke? Are you eating properly? Do you know how to set up your pack and play? These kinds of things are you know, blocking and tackling. So whereas clinicians have access to evidence-based medicine resources, even though we know from reports over the last decade, it's unfortunate only about half the time evidence-based medicine is actually practiced, either it's underused or overused, folks like community healthcare workers don't have the benefit of access to easily understandable, easily accessible guidelines. We've heard, especially in the Boston area, there's Atul Gawande who wrote the Checklist Manifesto. It's only in healthcare that you can make a best-winning prize-winning book on making checklists. So now how do you extend that to the mobile healthcare worker who knows the community really well? He knows these people. He can go, he or she go to their doors. It could be folks for disability, for pregnancy, for the 70-year-old male who gets confused about which one of his six meds to take. So how do you arm these folks with technology and knowledge? So what we've done is we're very focused. We've basically created a collaborative learning environment, and it's three components. We've created a component for sharing evidence-based medicine resources, over 1,000 articles that have been culled through CDC, Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, and mental health services agencies on best practices and guidelines for all those conditions I talked about. So how do you take those things? And we did about half a dozen focus groups. So we actually built a healthcare software system with the end user in mind and designed it for them and for ease of use. And we asked them, what's your day like? What are your challenges? What are you good at? And how do you overcome these challenges? And we heard this one woman, she basically has a little scribble sheet of the best transportation clinics, the best food clinics. So we've heard stories of diabetics. They had their transportation arranged to, unfortunately, they needed a foot amputation. And guess what? There was no transportation to take them home. I mean, they had an amputation cost, whatever, $50,000 or $100,000, and no one arranged that transportation. Well, it turns out it takes a community healthcare worker about 2 hours to arrange a ride that gets paid for by the hospital. Well, why can't we have the equivalent of Uber for sick people, right? Now, maybe Uber is a little hardcore, but we need some, you know, there's no reason why that can't be an automated transaction. But right now, so we're dealing with one, evidence-based practice resources. Area two is social services resources. So we're actually running a clinical trial that's about to start where we have 100 community healthcare workers across 5 cities in the US. They're each gonna be given a Verizon tablet, and all the subscription services are paid for that year. They even keep the tablet when they're done with the trial, where they can go on. And it's kind of like, imagine Angie's List for social services, plus a Reddit for evidence-based practices, plus a Quora, a question and answer function, and a rating function. Imagine that put all nicely together in healthcare. That's what we've built. And then finally, what we think is really exciting is that we're spinning off, to sustain the benefit of our grant, we're spinning off a nonprofit version that's going to be accessible to the country. And we think that by tackling this big area of social services and supporting those people that are really the front line of health, and with 10 million Americans serving as family caregivers, according to the Institute of Medicine, that's a big front line with 150,000 social workers, 150,000 community healthcare workers. Those are big front lines. And so that's the whole area of continuity of care we're dealing with, basically integrating and making accessible this whole silos of social services.
So let me ask if there's any questions now before I ask my next one. No one's going to jump in? Okay, so Summit in particular, but everybody can jump in on this. You know, we've talked a lot about gathering together all this data. And we're going to gather data from everywhere that has data about a person, which would include social media and other things. And then on the other side, we have these huge concerns around privacy. Both concerns, so you have the sort of creepy target, knows your daughter's pregnant before you do stuff, which might be less so in a clinical setting. We have that side, but then you have HIPAA and high tech and you know every other actual regulation. And we've had these discussions just you know in my role in the last couple of days. So how do you scale an operation like yours or Richard's where you're really focusing in on the individual and using community resources and you know how do you scale that while you're thinking about privacy and security and how data gets shared and used?
Great question. So I'll answer the question in several steps. One, obviously, because we're collecting data and we're putting it someplace, we're aggregating it, obviously we have to worry about just the physical security of the information itself. And that's not a new problem. It's not a problem that's unique to healthcare. It's a problem that many, many, many industries have had to solve. And the general IT community has solved that problem reasonably well. And we hear about data breaches in other industries, and we hear about data breaches in healthcare, and that's the current state of the art, right? What we've actually found as recently as last week, 2 weeks ago, a study came out, 69% of the American population said that they'd actually tolerate data breaches, they'd tolerate issues with data being inappropriately or misused if by having that data put someplace they got better healthcare. Now that's a very interesting statistic. The acceptance of risk for that benefit is something that seems to be becoming okay more and more. And yes, we're all worried about our employers and our insurance companies and et cetera, getting their hands on, we're finding out that we have a certain disease or a certain precondition or a certain predisposition to a problem. Well, there are now rules around, you know, even under Obamacare, some protections that are now built in on how that information can even be used. It's what the credit card companies did when they said, okay, your credit card now has a maximum limit on liability. Well, so you combine all these things, and you combine physical security, and you combine some protections, and you can actually overcome the basics of data sharing. Now the information's put someplace, and people tolerate that. Great. Now, who can have access to it? And what we've proven over the past literally 10 years, working very hard in states that range from, in the US, states that range from very, very restrictive in terms of how much consent is required to share data, to very, very permissive, where you know you share everything by default and you know you can opt out if you'd like, if you figure out that someone's sharing your information. Right? So that whole spectrum. And across the board, what we found is that the end result at the end of putting up a pretty large community, a million patients, 1.5 million patients, the end result of joining up data across that size community is about 94% of the individual in the communities remain opted in or opt-in. Now that's a pretty interesting statistic. People are willing to share the information with their care teams and have it be available at the point of care, at a moment of need, about 94% of the time. And the ones who opt out would opt out anyway.